315 CV US Concrete versus the Comptroller.
Thank you, and may it please the court. The issue in this appeal is how a ready-mix concrete company should calculate its franchise taxes for costs related to its mixer trucks and the operation of those mixer trucks. The tax code permits companies to subtract from their revenue calculations costs that relate to manufacturing. And here, importantly, the Comptroller concedes, as it must, that ready-mix concrete is manufactured in mixer trucks by truck operators. That is undisputed. Yet without offering any evidentiary basis, the Comptroller disallowed, arbitrarily, 70% of our mixer truck costs and 41% of our truck operator costs. We seek reversal because neither the code nor the record permit these arbitrary allocations. And I'll offer today three reasons, independent reasons, for a reversal of the ruling on these mixer truck costs and operator costs. First, because the mixer trucks are factories on wheels that cannot be divvied up into manufacturing and distribution components, the related truck and operator costs should be treated as manufacturing costs. The second reason is regardless of whether the disputed costs relate in part to distribution, they should be treated as manufacturing costs because their primary purpose was manufacturing. And third, the Comptroller's percentage disallowances here are arbitrary and cannot stand. There is no evidence or explanation offered anywhere to support the particular allocations. And finally, time permitting, I will address the Comptroller's erroneous treatment of our dispatcher costs. So turning to the first ground for reversal, all of our mixer truck costs and truck operator costs are includable manufacturing costs under subsection C of section 171.1012 of the tax code, the cost of goods sold statute. And they are not excludable distribution costs under subsection E3 of that statute. And to understand why, I think it'd be helpful to revisit this, how ready-mix concrete is manufactured. And if you could turn to, if I provided as an oral argument exhibit, tab 3, we walk through the four steps of the process with some pictures, which show that the mixer trucks and the truck operators are involved at every stage in the process. In the first step, the operators assist with the loading of the raw materials into the mixer truck at one of the 55 plants that U.S. Concrete has dispersed around Texas. And oftentimes they're adding water in that case and beginning the hydration process. In the second step, while en route to the customer, the materials are mixed in the truck's drum, and the drivers are constantly monitoring the drum and adjusting the rotation speed, or potentially adding water or chemical admixtures to the concrete material to make sure it's the right consistency.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Of course.
Is it my understanding, am I correct, that that usually happens if there's traffic or they're stuck in traffic, that if it's a, you know, good day, no traffic, not driving in Austin particularly, that the driver's not really doing much, I mean, with the concrete?
Well, there are a couple situations. If you're going up a hill, for example, that could change the composition, and they may need to change the rotation speed on the drum if there's certain conditions like that. But you're right, oftentimes there's traffic, and that could require the driver to stop the truck, get out, check it, add water, add chemicals, and get back in the truck and continue driving.
Thank you.
But the third step is at the customer's location, where the operator gets out of the truck again and performs a test to check the slump of the concrete mix. And if it's too wet, they'll add chemical admixtures. If it's too dry, they'll add water. And until they achieve once they achieve the customer's specifications, only then is the concrete discharged as a finished product and provided to the customer. And the fourth step is maintaining the equipment on the return trip to the plant or at the plant, other maintenance work that is performed. Now, again, the Comptroller has conceded that the manufacturing occurs during these four stages. But they argue that there's portions of these costs that we're incurring that can't be counted as cost of goods sold under subsection E3 of the statute. So I provided the statute at tab 1 for your convenience. And if you read section E and E3 together, you'll see that to be excluded from the cost of goods sold, the distribution costs must be in relation to a taxable entity's goods. And then when you look at A1 and you look at the definition of good, a good must be something that is sold in the ordinary course of business, in other words, a finished product. Here, we have no distribution costs because The concrete does not become a good, a finished product until it is discharged at the customer's location.
Do you agree that you bear the burden of proof on these matters, including whether or not this is appropriately a subtraction or a deduction or an exemption, and is there a differing burden depending on which category this would fall under?
That's a great question. So we have a burden, we have a preponderance of the evidence burden. That was our burden at trial. Now, the comptroller on 7 different occasions tells the trial court that this is a deduction
Supreme Court kind of uses the term interchangeably at times.
But if you read the statute, this statute, it has a number of different subchapters. They have a whole separate subchapter called exemptions. Mm-hmm. Then they have 106, 107 that are listed as deductions. They do not use that language when you're talking about the 3 different methods that you can subtract from the total revenue calculation. So you have a choice as a taxpayer to subtract. You can do 70% of your revenue, you can subtract your compensation, or you can subtract cost of goods sold. So we believe that the comptroller was wrong in informing the trial court that we were under some heightened burden.
Exemptions, those are to be construed strictly against the taxpayer, correct?
If the statute is ambiguous is the first step.
Right.
So if the statute is ambiguous, then an exemption or deduction would be construed against the taxpayer.
Right.
But if it's just a subtraction and it's ambiguous, then it would be construed in our favor.
So just a subtraction is still different than an exemption.
That's correct,
okay.
Your Honor.
Can I kind of piggyback on the first question of burden of proof? Let's assume for the sake of argument that we agree that there is part of these that are not COGS. If y'all have the burden of proof of the right allocation, and my understanding is, can you point me to the record anywhere where we would see what that allocation should be if the controller got it wrong?
Well, that goes to the Gulf Copper case, Your Honor, which is a case that this court decided about a year and a half ago. And that was a case where the taxpayer sought certain number of requested cost of goods sold. This court disagreed and found that they were entitled to some but not all of that amount, but also went back to the comptroller's allocation and said that it was flawed and not consistent with the statute. And the court in that case didn't say, well, taxpayer, you didn't prove it up under this other measure. We're gonna punch you. You remanded it back to the trial court for a determination of the proper of the COGS under the proper legal guidance.
So if we get to allocation.
So if you conclude that our threshold positions
Understood.
Are we believe we're entitled to 100%
right.
of our requested COGS.
If we get to allocation.
If you get to allocation, there's absolutely no way you can stand on the controller's allocations. They have, I'm sorry to be blunt, they didn't. There's absolutely nothing in the record at all that supports how they came to that calculation.
Mm-hmm.
There's no explanation of how they came to that calculation.
But did you bear the burden of rebutting it then?
Well, I would liken it to a situation where you have if you think about a typical case with a measure of damages situation, and the plaintiff is arguing, and it's unclear going into it what the proper measure is. The plaintiff proves up its damages under one measure that the trial court agrees with. The defendant argues for a different measure of damages. Then it goes up on appeal. If the Court of Appeals ultimately says, yes, there's some damages here, but we don't think this is the proper measure, the remedy is not just to say you had the burden to prove it under the right measure and zero out the plaintiff. What we do, and the Texas Supreme Court has done in numerous cases is, in that situation, you remand it back to the trial court for a calculation under the proper measure. But I want to really be clear that our threshold position here is that subsection E3 does not apply. You think of the typical factory case where the prototypical case that the statute is conceiving of is a factory that produces finished goods. And then they distribute them, they market them, they send them out to wholesalers and retailers, and that's really this division that subsection C and subsection E are looking at here: post-production distribution costs in relation to a good, a finished good. And in here, that's not what happens. We are literally a factory on wheels that is delivering the product at the customer's doorstep, so there are no distribution costs.
What's to prevent somebody from from some industry taking a product and like sending it cross country and then putting on a label or doing just something at the very last minute to actually absorb these distribution costs when really the manufacturing could have been accomplished. And I get that's not your facts, but what's to prevent somebody from doing precisely that under your reading of the statute?
Well, I think a court could see through that and say you're clearly trying to evade the statute here. You're making the good in your factory, and then you're slapping something on. But I think that's just so far removed from the factual situation here, where there's no dispute that the manufacturing is occurring on the truck between the plant and the customer's location. I do want to think about. I want to emphasize the implications of the controller's position here with respect to the allocations. I mean, for the mixer trucks specifically, they're basically saying we should divvy up this truck that is delivered to us as an integrated unit, and somehow figure out which parts are dedicated to distribution and which parts are dedicated to manufacturing. I mean, how do you value depreciation, maintenance costs, repair costs on a part by part basis with respect to a mixer truck? They don't tell us, and this court's precedents forbid that. And this court, Judge Justice Goodwin, you authored an opinion in American Multicinema versus Hager, where the...
It's pending down the hall, we'll see.
But it is pending in the Supreme Court, but the issues, if you look at the Supreme Court briefing, it's not on the issue that we're relying on. The question in that case was, it was a movie theater, and the controller attempted to divide it into separate production and distribution or consumption space. They argued the square footage associated with the speakers and the projector were production, and they tried to use the same provision, E3, to say the rest of the theater is consumption or distribution space. And this court properly rejected that argument and said the whole theater, there's evidence the whole theater works together acoustically and visually to produce the film experience. And the same testimony here, that the trucks are integrated units. The chassis and the drum are manufactured to fit with each other.
The windshield?
Windshield. We can't operate and we can't manufacture concrete if the windshield is broken. We take it out of commission. But
for the sake of argument, let's say that you're in the middle of a delivery and you're almost there and something hits the windshield and it is broken, you know. Are you going to tell me that they're going to go back to the plant or are they going to go and finish off delivering that concrete?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. That's not in the record. But the point is that they do hold out these trucks from, and they're short, usually 15-minute rides, so I don't know how often that happens. But the point is that they do take them out of service if even a minor component is needing repair, and that is in the record. But I want to, again, think through the implications of the argument here, because if you're allocating in the way that they're suggesting, think about a factory. I mean, are you going to divide up a factory into square footage that is connected to the assembly line and square footage that is associated with break rooms and other parts of the factory that aren't directly you part of the manufacturing process? Are you going to look at
it happens throughout the entire tax code?
But I think under the franchise tax, my understanding is that factories can you can deduct the cost of your factory. And for factory workers, are we going to start carving out, looking at each individual employee and saying, well, what percentage of their time is on break time? What percentage of their time are there sick days? And start allocating a factory worker's time that way? I don't think that's what cost by cost means when this court used that phrase in Gulf Copper. We're talking about categories of costs here. And the costs here are essentially factories. The mixer trucks are essentially factories. They happen to be mobile factories, but for the same reason, for the reason a factory is a manufacturing cost, so is a mixer truck. And I want to reemphasize on the arbitrary point. I think it's worth pointing out again that there's a controller called no witnesses at trial. There's no testimony. There's no explanation. They don't even mention the percentages anywhere in their brief. And in fact, their testimony is inconsistent. The positions they've taken in their appellate brief with respect to what categories of labor costs are includable as manufacturing costs and which categories are not, page 12 of their brief, is totally inconsistent with their auditor's deposition testimony, which is in the record at RR 72 through 76. Again, and I want to my second point, which I haven't had time to fully explore, but it's in our briefing. But even if you all conclude that there is some distributional component here, we urge you to apply the primary purpose test and conclude that the primary purpose here was manufacturing, and that any transportational element here was merely incidental. You've done that in the sales tax context, but this test, or the essence of the transaction test, I see they're running out of time. But those tests are appropriate anytime there's a mixed situation with mixed costs or mixed transactions, and even the controller has used that in the franchise tax context as well. I see that I've run out of time. I'll return.
I have another question. In the Gulf Copper case, is it your assertion that they did not provide a different scheme or, as to how you should divide what would be COGS and what wouldn't be?
So the taxpayer in that case, their methodology was to include all of their federal cost of goods sold under subsection H of the statute, and then backed out certain costs under subsection E. And this court said that was inappropriate. You can't start with the federal number. You have to show why the cost should be included under subsection C to begin with, is my understanding of the court's ruling in that case. And then the controller, on the other hand, had made some certain allocations that it believed were appropriate based on the portions it considered fabrication work and non-fabrication work. And the taxpayer in that case did not try to prove up an alternative number under the controller's allocation. They said the controller's allocation is wrong. Ultimately, they were right about that. And so, again, it's the same concept as measure of damages here. If you do find that there needs to be some real allocation, we ask for guidance and we ask for an opportunity to go back to the trial court to prove them up. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. U.S. Concrete produces and delivers ready-mix concrete. For it to prevail on the case that it pleaded, it has to prove it has no delivery costs. The evidence in the record shows that this is not the case. Because the trucks and the drivers both produce and deliver ready-mix concrete, the state should prevail for three independent reasons. First, subsection C of the cost of goods sold deduction only permits cost of producing the good as a cost of goods sold deduction. Second, subsection E specifically states that delivery costs, including outbound transportation costs, are not cost of goods sold under the statute. And third, the primary purpose test that U.S. Concrete is asking this court to apply is a misapplication of the statute, the case law that interprets it, and it's contrary to the comptroller's mixed transaction rule, which applies in the cost of goods sold scenario. Turning to my first point, under subsection C, all direct costs of producing the goods are cost of goods sold and may be deducted. But U.S. Concrete's drivers and trucks both produce and deliver the concrete. U.S. Concrete frequently calls it a manufacturing plant on wheels, but its argument is that it's all a manufacturing plant and no wheels. For instance, there's an uncontested finding of fact on the fuel, that some of the fuel propels the truck down the road. That is not a cost of producing ready-mix concrete. That is a cost of delivering ready-mix concrete. The testimony on that fact indicates that there is actually a device on the truck that determines how much fuel is being used to power the drum versus how much fuel is being used to power the truck and propel it down the road. And this device is on the truck because U.S. Concrete takes a deduction for the purposes of sales tax. They don't pay sales tax on the portion, or motor fuel tax. They don't pay motor fuel tax on the portion that powers the drum. They only pay it on the portion that powers the truck down the road. Now, the same thing.
There's evidence to that in the record?
The first witness in the case testified to that. His name was Rick Sezzi. I believe he's the president of the Texas Association of Concrete and Aggregates. He testified that there are these devices on the truck and that was the purpose of having the devices on there. We also have testimony that there are other portions of the truck that don't have any real function. Mr. Sezzi also testified that the wheels aren't really necessary. He was asked, if you put the concrete mixer up on a flatbed truck, can it still manufacture concrete? While he said it's not probable and as a scientific man, he wouldn't say it was likely, he indicated that it is possible. So there are portions of the truck that are solely delivery functions and not costs of producing the ready-mix concrete. And the same can be said of the drivers. The drivers are performing two tasks, production and delivery. Now, there's an uncontested finding of the fact that the drivers drive the truck, and that seems fairly obvious, but it's important here. The drivers are spending some of their time driving the truck, transporting and delivering the ready-mix concrete. They pay attention to the road. They pay attention to the speed limit, traffic laws, what lane they're in, things of that nature. The job description that's in the record indicates that they can't have moving violations, more than three moving violations within the last few years in order to work for U.S. Concrete. They can't have, they have to have a special driver's license. It says that their job is to load and deliver ready-mix concrete. They are not spending all of their time producing ready-mix concrete. Now, we do concede that they do spend some of their time, just as we concede that some of the truck does produce ready-mix concrete, and they do get a deduction for those tasks, but there's two things going on here.
Mr. Kennedy, can you point to us in the record where, how you came up, how the controller came up with the 59% and the 70%?
Your Honor, the record's undeveloped on that fact because of the way this case was pleaded. This case was pleaded that the comptroller cannot allocate as a matter of law and as a matter of fact. The issue of what the allocation should be was never raised. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I interrupted you.
It's a matter of whether, not what, in other words. So can we allocate versus what the allocation should be?
So then you would agree that if we see the things like the controller, then it has to be remanded back?
No, Your Honor. In this case, if it were remanded for the proper allocation, the court wouldn't have jurisdiction over that case because the protest letter in this case, again, just the issue that was contested was whether there can be any allocation.
You agree it's all or nothing?
Correct, Your Honor.
So neither of you are really interested in a remand?
Correct,
Your Honor. And I'll let you get to that later. Yeah.
That's not what I heard. I heard that U.S. Concrete is saying we want the all, but if we don't get the all, then we want a remand for a proper allocation.
But you're saying that question is not preserved?
Correct. That's our position, Your Honor, and I think that's an accurate reflection of what U.S. Concrete's position is as well. Now, I do want to turn to subsection E, because that
it's
was
a multi-cinema again, isn't it?
I think this case is actually very different for a lot of reasons, but the issue in this case is whether the production is going on, not that the state's not arguing that subsection E removes something from subsection C. In other words, if it's a cost of producing the ready-mix concrete, then U.S. Concrete gets it. If it's not a cost of producing, it doesn't. Subsection E is an illustrative list that shows what is not included in subsection C. So in subsection E, costs of delivering, including outbound transportation costs, are not costs of goods sold. So they're not costs of producing the good, which the two statutes work together to show what is and what isn't. Now, this court indicated in the SunState case that is how this is interpreted. So subsection C is really the issue. Is this a cost of producing? Subsection E provides you examples of what are not costs of producing. Outbound transportation, delivery costs being one of those costs. And I know there was a point raised about it can't be outbound transportation because it's not a good until it's delivered, but the statute is broader than that. It says in relation to a good. And this court has looked at the term in connection with and said that's a term of intentional breadth, and I would say the same thing about in relation to being a term of intentional breadth. So whether it's a good or not when it's being delivered doesn't implicate whether or not it's ultimately a cost of producing versus delivery. SunState talks about that what the statute is really trying to get at is cost of production versus selling costs. And that's precisely what this is.
Like selling costs, advertising.
Advertising, delivery, outbound transportation. So subsection C actually mentions inbound transportation costs. and says that inbound transportation costs are includable as a cost of goods sold, which makes sense. If you have a manufacturing plant and you're bringing the stuff to your manufacturing plant to manufacture, then you get the cost of goods sold for that because that's a cost of acquiring or producing the good that you have. But if it's a selling cost, in other words, if it's a cost that you incur in order to get it to someone else, that's not includable as a cost of producing the good.
Can I divert your attention a little bit?
Sure.
U.S. Concrete says that, you know, in y'all's, well, the controller's tax publication, 94-164, and I understand that's sales tax versus franchise tax. It describes the ready-mix concrete as a processed with special equipment while being transported. Isn't being processed enough to qualify for the COGS?
We don't dispute that they qualify for the cost of goods sold deduction. There's just two different things going on. So that I believe that's a sales tax context, which deals with transactions versus costs. What we're talking about here are which costs are allocable to production versus which costs are allocable to non-production. Here we're talking specifically about delivery. So there are some costs of delivery. The position that they're taking is there are no costs of delivery, but they are delivering the ready-mix concrete to their customers. That's part of their business, and that's in the record on page 201, I believe. Now Paulson signed an affidavit saying U.S. Concrete's business is producing and delivering the ready-mix concrete. So there's two distinct functions going on here, two distinct tasks. And that kind of gets to the primary purpose test that was discussed earlier. So I think that's a good segue into addressing that. The primary purpose test is in sales tax. When there's a transaction that involves both a sale of tangible personal property and a sale of services, in sales tax, we look at what's the primary purpose of that transaction. If it's a service, we don't tax it. If it's a sale of tangible personal property, we tax it. But for purposes of the COGS deduction, what we're talking about is the mixed transaction rule in 34 Texas Administrative Code 3.588C7. It's actually the direct opposite of the primary purpose test. It says if there's a transaction that's a sale of tangible personal property and a sale of a service, you look at the sale of the tangible personal property and you look at the sale of the service and you get the cost of goods sold for the sale of the tangible personal property and you don't get it for the services. So it's actually the direct opposite test, and this court applied that test in NTS Communications recently. It also complies with the Gulf Copper analysis that requires a cost-by-cost analysis of what's going on in that manufacturing drum, of what's going on in terms of the costs. So again, here we're talking about cost of producing, which, sorry, did you have a question, Your Honor?
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think that's where, you know, the rub lies under Gulf Copper. I think that that's what the court found, that you have to, you can't just assign a percentage, you have to go cost by cost. And so then the question is, you know, are you correct in saying, well, they had the burden of proof and they didn't bring it up, and so therefore, you know, we are relieved from showing or proving the allocation? Or is it more like U.S. Concrete is arguing, well, you still have to prove the allocation regardless of whether it's a all or nothing, the way that they brought it up to the court?
Sure. And there is some evidence in the record from a deposition testimony of the comptroller auditor on how she reached the intermediary number. I say intermediary because there were three numbers here. So she initially audited U.S. Concrete, came up with a percentage. Then she looked at everything again, came up with another set of numbers. And then she did a site visit and all kinds of other things and came up with a third set of numbers. So there's some evidence as to how she reached the allocation in the middle, and what she was considering was manufacturing and things like that. And she was looking at how to allocate between these costs and indicates that she was doing a cost-by-cost analysis. Now, what numbers were in the cost-by-cost analysis, again, that's not in the record. And it's our position that it's not in the record because the way this was pled was, can there be an allocation as a matter of law or as a matter of fact, because they had both positions. U.S. Concrete took the position that as a matter of law, you can't allocate between these two things. The COGS statute doesn't require that. And I think Gulf Copper actually dispels that. And then the second point is, as a matter of fact, you can't separate these apart, because I think the position is this is one unit and this is one person. But if, for instance, on the person aspect of it, if it's two separate people doing the test, we're not having any argument. But what we're talking about really is costs of performing the tasks. So they're performing both functions in this case. So the costs, there are some allocable to production, and there have to be some allocable to delivery. The delivery doesn't cost nothing. There's something there. I want to turn back to actually dispatcher costs. I have a few minutes for that, because I realized that dispatcher costs were raised in this case. There's actually one line of testimony that I think just completely explains what the issue is on the dispatchers. The dispatchers were permitted to take the deduction as an indirect cost under subsection F. Now at trial, it's on page 213 of the reporter's record, volume 2. The last witness.
Could you repeat that?
It was second volume of the reporter's record, page 213, line 4 through 6. The witness was asked whether or not the dispatchers produce concrete or whether they just talk to the drivers and the customers. And the witness indicated that they do not produce ready-mix concrete, that they just talk to the drivers and to the customers. I'm sorry. And so the point there is they're not actually doing any production. These are indirect costs of production. Whether they're trained in how to do it or not, they're not actually doing it. And there's a video in the record as well. You don't see any dispatchers in that video. And there's several other points on that. Unless there's any other question, I'll give the rest of my time back to the court.
No.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Just to start off by saying there was no defense presented of the allocations here. I just want to note that for the record. The argument that there was some kind of pleading defect on our part, I think, is mischaracterizes the record. If you look at, we pled over and over again that this allocation was arbitrary. And just a couple places I was able to find CR 174, CR 177 in our amended pleadings where we talk about the arbitrary and capricious nature of the allocation that we believe we challenged on appeal.
But did you have a separate burden to establish in the alternative a different?
Your Honor, I don't think we did. I think if they did in Gulf Copper and got a remand, and I think if you think about my example about measure of damages, say there's confusion and okay. We think it's measure X and somebody, the defendant says it's measure Y, we don't have to prove up the measure Y damages too. That's not what happens in the Formosa case in the Texas Supreme Court or any of the other, there are multiple examples. We want a remand in the sense that if that's all we get, we think we're entitled to it. We think this court should conclude under that we're entitled to all of our cost of goods sold. And I want to talk about revisit E3 again because
right, the selling costs, advertising. I mean, do you concede that those outgoing costs are not?
That's right, and we didn't count those as cost of goods. I mean, so E3 is getting at finished goods. It's about selling finished goods, about marketing finished goods. It's about distributing finished goods. Mm-hmm. That's what you have in a typical case, but this is not the typical case. This is the case where the manufacturing is occurring while mobile. If you had the fact that there's a transportational element does not mean it's not a cost of goods sold. If we have a forklift in a factory that's transporting goods from one assembly line to another, that's transportation, but it's still a cost of goods sold. It's part of the manufacturing process. And the same rationale applies here. The phrase, well, again.
So I live in a concrete house, literally. I mean, it's an ICF house. It was filled up with, but I paid for both products, the concrete that I was purchasing and for them to deliver and put it in my walls. I mean,
we don't do that.
But to deliver it to the site and do whatever it is that has to be done with it.
That's right.
Which is what I think the comptroller's point is in terms of that, I think in subsection E, that's an outgoing delivery cost.
But I think the key phrase there is in relation to a good, and I think the fact that
and it doesn't become a good until it's on site.
That's right. It's okay. Under the statute, it's have to be sold in the ordinary course of business, and so
can you point us anything in the statute that says that prevents distribution or outbound transportation from occurring in the middle of production?
I think it's the nature of the word good. I mean, it's the distribution has to be, costs have to be in relation to a good, or selling costs in relation to a good, a finished product. It's the fact that it's the good, definition of good is that it's sold in the ordinary course of business. So again, the forklift example is an example of that. If you're moving things around in a factory, that's that cost of that forklift and the forklift operator should be a manufacturing cost. And I do want to say a word about the fuel cost, too. I think under the plain text of C3, which says cost of materials that are consumed in the ordinary course of performing production activities, all the fuel we used are being used while this manufacturing plant on wheels is doing its thing and making the concrete and delivering it to the customer. It doesn't work if you...
Is the comptroller correct, and is there anything in the record to support this assertion that part of the motor fuels tax is not being assessed as to that portion of the fuel that operates the drum?
There is testimony that says that there's a way to divide the fuel cost between the parts that operate the drum versus the parts that propel it down the road. That is the case. But we think the entire scope of the fuel cost falls squarely within definition of C3. And we also believe that, again, if this truck isn't moving, it's not manufacturing concrete. It's useless. Right. I mean, you can't just take the wheels off and manufacture something with the drum rotating by itself there. It doesn't work. You have to keep it moving, and you have to bring it to the customer and deliver it according to the customer's specifications.
Can I ask you? I'm sorry.
Of course.
Mr. Schattenberg, will you address the dispatcher's cost and why that's not, mixed?
So the dispatcher costs, there's an agreement there that they are, that the dispatcher costs are costs of manufacturing. There's no dispute there.
The question is whether they're
direct or indirect. And so subsection F of the statute provides a 4% cap on indirect costs.
Correct.
And the statute itself talks about the types of, it lists a number of different functions that it considers indirect costs. Legal. Accounting, financial services, security, back office tasks. And I can walk you through the briefing, but we go into great detail in our briefs about how integrally involved the dispatchers are in the production of the concrete. They have specialized manufacturing training about how to manufacture concrete. They're the primary interface with the customer. They're constantly dealing with the drivers, navigating through traffic, lining up the trucks, advising the operators about what to do in the case of the slump being too dry, I think, or too wet. There's sometimes the dispatcher will say, come back to the plant and provide guidance to the truck operators. So they're at every stage of the process, and I'll leave it to the briefing. I see that I'm out of time. They're integrally involved, and so we believe those costs should be considered direct costs and not subject to the cap under subsection F. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. The case will be submitted.